Hi, everyone, and welcome to the week ahead. I'm Tony Natch. Today, we're joined by Mike Green, Tracy Schuchart, and Albert Marco. We've got some key themes today. Of course, late this week, we saw the U.S. fire some missiles at Yemen over the Red Sea issues. We're going to jump into that a little bit in Tracy's section on industrial metals, and we'll talk a little bit about crude, a little bit about shipping, that sort of thing. But we're going to first cover Bitcoin ETFs, inflation, and labor data with Mike. Mike covers everything, so we want to kind of jam a lot in there. With Tracy, we want to talk about industrial metals and some of the junior miners, which she's been paying attention to. And with Albert, we want to talk about central banks and really the influence of Yellen on some of these, on obviously the Fed and some of these other central banks. So before we get started, I want to let you know about a new free tier we have within CI Markets, our global market forecasting platform. We want to share the power of CI Markets with everyone. So we've made a few things free. First, economics. We share all of our global economics forecasts for the top 50 economies. We also share our major currency forecasts, as well as Nikkei 100 stocks. So you can get a look at what do our stock forecasts look like. There is no credit card required. You can just sign up on our website and get started right away. So check it out. CI Markets free. Look at the link below and get started ASAP. Thank you. So guys, exciting evening. There's stuff going on in the Middle East. It seems like the punchline always ends here. But earlier this week, we saw a lot about the Bitcoin ETF and the approval of that. First, the non-approval of it, and then the approval of it. Mike, you and I first spoke about Bitcoin, I think a couple of years ago when the PLA in China was the largest miner of Bitcoin.
Yep.
Of course, Bitcoin is at what, 75% since October, which is totally normal for an asset, right? We have Cathie Wood saying that the base case for Bitcoin is $600,000. We have Vanguard and a bunch of other firms saying they won't allow crypto ETFs on their platform. So what happens with this? I mean, does Bitcoin, even with the spot Bitcoin ETF, does it still stay this kind of fringy, exciting, volatile asset, or does it really come into being kind of a normative type of asset that people invest in? I'm not pro or anti-Bitcoin here. I'm just trying to really understand what's the implication of this Bitcoin ETF?
Well, I think what the Bitcoin ETF does is exactly what the Bitcoin proponents highlight, is that it makes it available to more individuals at lower effort. So those who are very interested in owning Bitcoin would have made the effort to put themselves onto Coinbase or onto alternative exchanges to obtain it, or they would have mined it. Now, suddenly it's easily available in an ETF framework, right? It's not dissimilar. A lot of people have compared it to the introduction of the GLD ETF that made gold easily available for many retail investors relative to going to a coin store and buying physical gold or arranging for wholesale delivery in some way, shape, or form, or buying miners, right? And so one of the things that we've already started to see is a derating of many of the proxies for Bitcoin. Things like the miners, things like MicroStrategy, et cetera, have derated fairly sharply in the immediate lead up to this, even as they benefited from the appreciation of Bitcoin. By the way, I think the Bitcoin appreciation is more than you're actually highlighting, but that underlying dynamic, I think, is likely to play out here as well, where if you were buying through a proxy, this now allows you to buy theoretically direct access to Bitcoin. I personally think that this is going to be more of a sell the news type framework. That certainly seems to be what's playing out. And so it's adverse for both things like Coinbase and MicroStrategy, as well as Bitcoin itself, candidly. People purchase in advance of an event that's as easily available and not and well known as this. I got to be honest with you, I don't know that there's going to be that much dramatic volume that actually transits over to Bitcoin. As much enthusiasm as we see on Twitter, et cetera, for Bitcoin at this point, the Google search volumes, the interest in it, the actual utility of Bitcoin has fallen and not substantively changed in any meaningful way over the last, couple of years. And so I just kind of see this as a nothing burger. I had a joke where I was going to, pull up the scene from Jerry Maguire where Cuba Gooding Jr. says, people can have the coin, but they can't have the quan. I think Bitcoin has lost the Quan. I don't think anyone really cares or really believes that this is the future of finance anymore.
Right. So, and something I was saying earlier this week is I don't understand if there's such inherent value in Bitcoin, immutable inherent value, then why is everyone pumping it up pre the ETF? Like, I just feel like there's this expectation that because it's an ETF, it's going to, multiple X. But if the inherent value is already there, why aren't we already close to the inherent value?
Well, when you talk about the inherent value, I mean, again, it becomes a question of what is intrinsic or inherent value actually
Intrinsic, yeah.
mean? Yeah.
So
So,
it has the intrinsic value of a cell in my Excel workbook, is what I believe. But
yeah, that's basically what it is. I mean, look, Bitcoin itself is the token that is released as payment to the accountants on the blockchain, Bitcoin blockchain. That's it. That's all it is. And everything else we're engaged in is secondary trading of those tokens. Now, it's some point, right, under a proof of stake type framework, people might actually value those bitcoins as a mechanism for providing collateral to prove transactions or to underwrite transactions. But that's not the current configuration.
right.
I mean, that's what's happening in staking or other components, but that's not what's actually happening in the Bitcoin network itself. And so, we're now 10 plus years in, and in contrast to something like AI that I use on a daily basis now, like other than speculative trading, I still am not at all sure what anyone thinks we're getting out of Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's not a currency. I mean, we've talked about this before. It's an asset, it's not a currency, right?
It
And
is a
so.
speculative, it is a speculative asset that, in my opinion, remains largely inflated on the basis of a flawed underlying belief system.
But I think you just don't get it, Mike.
Yeah, that's it. No, I haven't done the work, and
You
I'm
obviously
having
haven't done
fun
the work,
staying
and
poor,
you don't get it.
and I've accepted that I'm not going to make it. I'm just not sure what else can be thrown at me.
Right. Not gonna make it. Albert, jump in here. I mean.
I don't even know if I want to jump in here. I'm happy for Mike to take all the blowback that's coming from him, from all the crypto guys, because I've taken heat for it for years, saying that the thing's a speculative asset and not a reserve currency and all that other Ponzi nonsense that gets spouted out there. And I think Mike is absolutely correct. This is a sell event, sell the event type thing. I mean, most likely helping those, big clients that hold crypto to for an exit event for
Absolutely.
yeah. So but then the whole Bitcoin appreciation to $1 million, like Cathie Wood is spouting out there, is a belief system. Like, who's the next bag holder? And having an ETF takes that away completely for these people. So this is
Right.
why I can't really add on to what Mike said. He's spot on.
Right. And until Bitcoin has a global military presence, it's really not easy to enforce the value of
It's
that currency,
yeah,
right?
but I mean, we can make a joke like that, but that's actually accurate. And on top
Of
of that,
course it is.
Bitcoin doesn't even do anything. It needs government systems to transact, whether it's the internet, financial institutions, so on and so forth. So it's not its own like entity that's living, outside of the central system.
Yep.
It doesn't do that.
Okay, good. So again, people who are going to hate what we said about Bitcoin will take it on. We're not going to make it. We've already accepted that, as Mike said. So,
How
I'm
can
sure
you
we'll
take
see some
seriously
really
anything
interesting
coming from a
comments.
guy who's drinking coffee from a little mug that has a little birdie on the handle? Come on.
That's right, exactly. Okay, very good. So next I want to hear a little bit about your inflation outlook, Mike. So earlier this week you said that demand configuration for the US is not supportive of higher inflation, and that wage growth presents headwinds for inflation. So do you think inflation stalls out and potentially goes negative for a short period this year? You had this great Brookings graph you sent out. So what's your thinking, and kind of, I guess, also in terms of maybe the timing, like where do we hit that point where the headwinds are strongest against inflation in 24?
Well, so there's a number of things that are going on in terms of the lagged components in the inflation dynamics, right? So many people have correctly highlighted the dramatic increases in insurance rates, for example, which are now basically driving all of the increase in transportation services, for example, right? Those are a distinctly lagged component that's tied to the dramatically higher costs of vehicles and tied to the higher cost of parts and service, right? So if I total my car, or if I crash my car, the insurance company has to replace it with an equivalent vehicle. If the price of those vehicles is dramatically higher, guess what? But the insurance policy is going to have to increase because the frequency of accidents hasn't changed, right? And if anything, it's increased as Americans have become nuttier and nuttier over the past few years. The, so when you're, and candidly watching my own Gen Z children drive, I'm terrified for the future of the roads and eagerly awaiting the self-driving vehicles. But so you're looking at a situation in which what's happening today in many of these categories reflects asset price changes that happened last year. And as I look forward to next year, what's the rationale other than an extreme expression of market power, which candidly is likely to be reversed by a variety of regulatory decisions that basically put pressure on the insurance agencies for doing stuff that's very distinctly unpopular, right? And I'm not arguing that's good, but I'm just acknowledging that that's highly probable. You're actually looking at a situation where what's going to cause it to increase by a similar magnitude next year? I can't really identify why that would happen, right? In housing, we're seeing similar components. Again, the frequency of burning your home down has not changed to any meaningful degree at the same price that the cost of replacing that home has gone up dramatically. We've also seen dynamics of concentration, et cetera, some market power components, but it becomes very hard to imagine that we're going to see anything that looks remotely like what we saw in the past 12 months in the next 12 months. And so all of those create headwinds. And the thing that I'm talking about in terms of the configuration for inflation is, remember, when a supply chain disruption occurs, you basically need to recover an element of the lost production, right? If I choose to not replace my car because it's expensive, I will ultimately have to replace that car. I just want to be very clear. I'm not going to replace it 1.5 times to make up for that lost component. I've just used my old car, or I've figured out how to borrow somebody else's car over that time period. But there is an element of catching up that ultimately has to happen. The configuration I'm referring to is if you have very rapid population or labor force growth, what that means is that demand is going to rise in the interim period, right? So not only are you going to have that catch up, but you're going to have to match that next part. And that's what was really unique in the 1970s, was every time you encountered a supply disruption, supply would fall 5%. Demand in terms of the number of people was rising in the neighborhood of 3 to 5%, which meant that you had to make up 10% as much production in order to just get back to the base case, right? And that is a very different configuration than we have today, where the population's really not growing at all, right? In particular, the high consumption labor force components are just not growing in any meaningful fashion. So the headwinds are dramatically less than people are used to thinking about in terms of the dynamics of inflation. So the flip side, the counter to my argument at this point, is many of the cyclical components, things like oil, et cetera, have been under distinct pressure. Those will likely emerge. There certainly will be times over the course of the year, particularly if we're engaged in combat with Houthis in the Red Sea, et cetera. As Tracy has pointed out in our pre-conversation, this is going to slow the transit of oil. It means that more oil needs to be in inventory, which means all else equal, we need more production, et cetera. But those, while they certainly can be a temporary influence, once you start making it around the horn, or start making it around the Cape instead of going, through the Red Sea, once you solve that once, once that inventory is out there and there's no shortage of OPEC production capability, as you're well aware, you've resolved the problem, right? It just doesn't work in quite the same way. And yes, I know that there's slightly more use of oil tankers as you're longer in transit, et cetera, but we solve supply problems very easily unless demand is taking off. And we just don't see any signs that demand is taking off in any meaningful way.
Right. So, okay. So there are two components. The one is the good side, which you've talked about with crude and manufacturing and demand, kind of more people in the workforce or whatever. I think the other side is the services side. And that seems to be moderating, right? That's what you're saying with the wages.
Well, you're seeing them moderate on two fronts, right? So one is that the unemployment rates for the least skilled in our society are beginning to rise as immigration has picked up dramatically, and those jobs are there's increasing competition for those jobs. That's an important component to it. The second is when you have this type of extreme move in services, you actually start something, or shortages in labor, you start something in motion that you can't stop once it's started, And the only other time, I just want to emphasize, the only other time we saw a contraction in services employment, and the ISM services employment is a warning sign, in my opinion. When you see a contraction in services employment, that's a really bad thing because that has been the underlying growth engine of the US economy for the past 70, 80 years, has been the continued share gain of services in the economy. But people forget that that's coming off of an extremely high level of what we would call marketable activity beforehand, right? So we talk about GDP and we think about the sale of washing machines. Well, what did we have before the sale of washing machines? We had services called washerwomen that would go around and do your laundry for you. What were the 1920s and 1930s all about? They were actually about the introduction of electricity and automation into the home, where many of those services that had been outsourced to low-end workers were suddenly productized. And we're seeing this same underlying dynamic, right? How many people, I don't know if anyone on this call has a robotic vacuum, but that's a big innovation along the lines of something like a dishwasher, right? They're now incorporating mopping capabilities, et cetera. Our alarm systems are increasingly not installed by ADP or ADT, I'm sorry. You order them from Amazon and you plug them in, right? All of these services that we have traditionally thought of as being recession resistant, suddenly being replaced by products. And that's a real, I actually think this is a really underappreciated and important feature of the current environment.
I think you're
Same thing, by the way,
exactly
you're
right.
saying,
Sorry.
walk through a McDonald's. I mean, go to a McDonald's. Don't eat the food, but go to a McDonald's, right? And actually look at the difference versus where it used to be, right? You now go to a kiosk. You don't even have to interact with a human being. The labor content in the kitchen, the franchises are gaining versus the local diner because there's a shortage of workers. There's been a relative shortage of workers that's encouraged McDonald's and Burger King and others to engage in labor-saving devices that they can take advantage of, but are very hard at this point for the local diner to take advantage of. That's led to share gain. It's led to relative price improvement for them versus others. And as those things filter through society, it's no different than replacing the washerwoman with the washing machine. It's no different than replacing the, 37-piece orchestra with a Victrola, right? It's no different than the radio or the television, introducing dramatically more forms of entertainment, but they can be broadcast to everybody else. These innovations roll out very, very quickly once they hit that threshold. And the one that, candidly, like everyone's kind of poo-pooing it now, but it's getting closer and closer, are things like self-driving vehicles.
Oh yeah, that'll be amazing once it happens. I mean, I want everyone else to go first, but once it's viable, I think it'll be incredible. So I hear what you're saying on the services low end, and I think that's fascinating in terms of a lot of those low end services workers. I do keep hearing about how, say, retail stores who've done self-checkout, some of them are going back and not doing self-checkout. That seems like a process that needs some calibration, rather than a fundamental kind of reversion back to using people. I just don't know. But I also think about, and I know this has been talked about for a year now, but when I was with larger research firms and I had to hire an entry-level master's educated, say, analyst, and I'd pay him $70,000+ a year, most of that stuff can be done through a $20 subscription for some sort of AI platform now, right? And so it's the low end, say, customer services jobs. It's also, I think, a lot of the low end white collar jobs that are being innovated. Are they ready to be fully innovated and fully automated right now? Probably not. But we're at this point, as you mentioned, where that stuff is plausible now. And it wasn't just 2 or 3 years ago. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's absolutely correct. And I think, again, this is the inevitable march of technology. Once you create this type of impulse, nobody wants to change unless they're forced to, right? And when you encounter the type of disruption that we've actually encouraged, it forces people to rethink business models. It forces them to redesign kitchens. It forces them to make choices that are accommodative for a shortage of labor. And they don't reverse that when the shortage of labor reverses, right? You don't turn around and you're like, oh, you know what? I really, there's like a very real example, the push for the invention of the horseless carriage in the 1870s. It led to the prizes to Carl Benz and others for the creation of horseless carriages. was created by the Great Epizootic Plague that led to roughly a third of the horses worldwide dropping dead in the streets. Right? When you have that type of event and you end up replacing the horses that are in shortage or creating the technology to replace it, it's not like suddenly people sat there in 1910 and like, oh my gosh, look at all the horses around, right? Like, we really should go back to those things, right? Let's stop using cars and trucks and let's go do lots of horses. I'm sure people are tempted to do that, but you know, I have yet to see and you know people saddled cowboys on the highways with me. So it's you know, I think people just forget this stuff. Once it happens, once it's been sold, it applies to human labor as well as commodities. The cure for high prices is high prices.
That's right. Okay, let's move on to jobs data and NFP and labor data. And I know this isn't a new topic for you, Mike. You've been talking about it for years. But obviously, NFP gets a huge amount of attention every month when it comes out. I've got a tweet from 2023, but I've seen them from you from 2020 and before, commenting on, say, the accuracy or misrepresentation of things like birth death adjustments within unemployment data. Can you talk us through that kind of a little bit? Kind of on a little bit of a novice level, so that people can understand, because we're hearing about, jobs data. We've heard about it for the last 2 years about how things are amazing, and this isn't a partisan thing because it happened before this administration. But can you talk us through that and how it impacts the, say, the unemployment rate and the number of, say, new jobs created, that sort of thing? Hey, I'd like to make sure you know that you can access our AI-driven market forecasting tool called CI Markets for free. No strings attached, and it does not require any credit card information. Go to completeintel.com/markets to subscribe. CI Markets is the perfect addition to your analysis toolbox. This free account includes Nikkei stocks, major currency pairs, and global economics. Of course, we offer much more in our paid account, but this lets you experience CI Markets before making a financial commitment. CI Markets uses the power of AI to help you make better trading investment decisions. It's absolutely free. Again, go to completeintel.com/markets to subscribe to CI Markets free.
Sure. So what you're referring to is what's called the birth death adjustment. This is an attempt by the BLS that was introduced originally, I believe, in 2000, and then reconstituted in 2012 and again in 2020, that attempts to model the new business formations that lead to employment but would not necessarily be captured by survey methodology, right? It's hard enough for most of us to figure out who startups are. Add on a layer of government bureaucracy, there's absolutely no chance they're going to figure out who they are. So they make an assumption that there's a certain pace of new business formations that's occurring, right? There's all sorts of adjustments that are made, and I encourage people to just be very careful in the treatment of the data. The birth death adjustments are non-seasonally adjusted. They need to be applied to the non-seasonally adjusted numbers. And even when you do that, it's not really quite as simple as everybody thinks because every month has its own unique characteristics to it. But you can be pretty safe by looking at something like the trailing 12-month contributions to the birth death adjustment. The second thing that's really important is to remember that the birth death adjustment, this modeling of new businesses, by definition, doesn't apply to government jobs. Right, because there are new governments being founded. I'm unaware of a 51st state. Puerto Rico's, you know, trying to avoid it. You know, but there are no new governments in process, right? So there is no element of birth death associated with it. And so all of these assumptions are tied to the private sector. And so what we've actually seen is we've seen a dramatic slowdown in hiring from the private sector. We've seen a dramatic decrease in new jobs coming from the private sector, with most of the jobs now coming from public or things tied to like medical care. And as a result, like it just gets crazier and crazier to be modeling that there's a constant and continuing increase of new businesses that are happening in the private sector. And this methodology does a terrible job. I actually will just share the chart. I've shown a so. You know, according to the BLS, right, this is the source of private sector jobs. This is the private sector payrolls numbers, ex birth death. This is the trailing 12-month net birth death adjustment, which gets rid of the seasonality, as you can see. And, you know, one of the features is post-COVID, we supposedly entered into a new era of entrepreneurship, et cetera. But those jobs are now accounting, those quote unquote, made up assumed jobs are now accounting for more than half of the private sector job creation. Right. And,
It's
this
everyone's
we've,
side gig while they're working from home.
yeah. And there's also that second component that you do have to be somewhat careful of, which is as an economy weakens and people face deteriorating finances in their household, they seek out a second job. And so we've also seen a surge in jobs that are, secondary jobs, even for those with full-time employment, as they effectively attempt to tap into what remains a robust labor market and, improve their individual situation, right? But as they do that, they increase the supply of labor that's available. They begin to pressure wages. And that's really what we're seeing is that real wages, for all the hoopla about the fact that they turned positive, congratulations, really that's more tied to falling inflation numbers than anything else. We're actually seeing nominal wage gains deteriorate fairly significantly. And we're seeing real wages on an effective basis, adjusting for reduced hours and everything else. Those are basically totally flat. Right. So there is no growth. There is no growth in employment. There is no, outside of some government jobs, there is no growth in wages. And like that's stagnation, right? That's creating an economy that's heading into a recession. And I don't think it's a coincidence. Obviously, this is a relatively short data series. But, when you see this crossover, when you see this slow moving, effectively, fixed component become the majority of jobs, they're not really happening, is kind of the easiest way to put it. And I think this is a big chunk of the revisions that we're seeing, et cetera. We also just saw the household survey, and this is actually important. But the household survey just saw a dramatic change, a decrease in full-time employment and jobs overall. That's tied to population adjustments. It's not like the survey suddenly went out and like, oh, look, all these people lost their jobs in December. People tend to underappreciate that. But what that actually is confirmation of my concern around these components, because when you restate the household numbers, or you do the household numbers, they're not restated in the same way the revisions are done for the NFP. It basically is just telling us that the employment gains for 2023 were largely fictitious.
Okay, yeah, let's dig into that a little bit. So, we have seen for the last, what, 6 months, or is it the last 12 months, the previous prints revised down always. And the way it feels to me is that they're continuing to shuffle forward, say, 20,000 to 30,000 jobs. They take it from the past, put it in the future, take it from the past, or take it from the past, put it in the current, take it from the past, put it in the current. And it's this statistical shell game of moving things forward and then adjusting it down later on. Whether that's intentional or not, that's really the way it appears. So why is that happening? I mean, you can't always, if your model doesn't adjust after a while, you have to figure out what's wrong with your model, right? Rather than just keep continuing to move these things. So what's going on there? I mean, honestly, to me, it appears very manipulative.
Yeah, no, and unfortunately, I think so first of all, I don't think it's actually, and Albert could probably comment on this as well, but I don't actually think it's intentional. I don't think that there's, like green eye shade accountants in the BLS who are like, boy, I'm really looking to pump up the numbers for Joseph Biden, right? The methodology is really critical here. So the non-farm payrolls is an establishment survey where effectively a form is filled out, submitted electronically by businesses saying, we created X number of jobs, right? The response rates to that survey have plummeted. They've fallen from about 70% pre-COVID to today. They're running in the 30% range. Part of that's work from home. Part of that's the fact that people just don't care as much. Part of that is that there's no penalty associated with it. So why would I bother, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? When you fail to respond to that survey, the assumption methodology is that those who failed to respond to the survey expanded in the same way that those who responded to the survey, right? So you're effectively taking what had been a 70% response rate and forecasting 30% to get to that 100%. Today, we're taking 30% and assuming that everybody else is there. That naturally leads to overstatements because I'll just be really straightforward. Who's more likely to respond to a survey? Somebody whose business is going well or somebody whose business is imploding? Right. And so when you talk about the change in the model, the irony is all of these models use what's called an ARIMA methodology, which is a autoregressive,
Just a moving average.
It's correct. It's a rolling regression, to be very precise, right? And that's the equivalent of you are driving your car in a straightaway and you see the turn up ahead. You have to start adjusting for it in advance. But if you're only using your rear view mirror and incorporating the data as it comes, you're going to be eternally late for that turn. And by
So
the time you
seriously,
start
that's
exiting,
all they use is Arima? Like, I had no idea it was that simple.
it's really that simple.
Oh my gosh. So, okay, so and for people who don't follow Mike, I'm sure everyone does, but Mike is very good at pulling out to and explaining methodologies. So I'm a nerd about methodologies. I'm less vocal about it because it's really hard to explain. Mike is very good at understanding these methodologies and explaining them in very understandable ways. So if you're using government data prints, and I know a lot of government data prints are kind of trade the news, but you have to understand the methodology and you have to understand the issues associated with those methodologies. I trust very few government data prints. Unemployment, retail sales, consumer spending, these are the worst data prints globally. GDP, of course, the worst data prints globally. But if you are not following Mike, look back on his historical tweets. He's excellent at explaining the methodological issues associated with government data, especially in the US.
Yeah, no, well, I think that's first, you emphasize the right part, especially in the US. The second component is that because I'm not a natural mathematician, it's important for me to really dig into these things and make sure that I can actually understand what the hell is going on. I think this is one of the challenges people who are naturally gifted at math. They'll look at a series like, oh, of course, right? But they often don't then lead themselves to the question of, well, what does this imply? And how does this model differ from the real world, right? The model becomes the territory as compared to the actual physical territory becoming it. And candidly, just I think being old, one of the primary skills that you bring, you can no longer bring computational intensity and speed. You can basically just bring a, yeah, no, that's wrong, right? That can't possibly fit the data sets that we're seeing properly. And it would be exactly like an ARIMA methodology as you're going into a turn at high speed, right? It's you know
You just
that you're
keep going
looking
straight.
forward and you have to adjust, and the ARIMA is telling you it's basically a straight road, right? No,
Right.
it's not. I'm looking at it,
Right.
right?
Exactly.
But the second thing that becomes really interesting though is that a lot of the tools that we use for leading indicators, things like what the stock market is doing or what the credit market spread, the credit spreads are doing, those themselves have actually been turned into lagging methodology by virtue of the way we choose to invest in them now. So it used to be that you'd have a legion of individual investors or portfolio managers that were directing most of the assets on a discretionary basis. They'd see the data sets begin to change. They'd see things begin to slow. They'd begin to rotate their portfolios into higher cash allowances and into safety. Right? That became the dominant feature in the market. And as that was occurring, as thoughtful application of those principles was being applied, the stock market was a leading indicator.
Yep.
Today, the dominant flows into stock markets are simply passive allocations from 401k plans. So if you have a job, which is a lagging indicator, you are investing 100% of your normal proceeds into the market, unless you're in the very rare minority of people who are changing your allocations. Right. And that in turn means that the stock market has now actually turned into a lagging tool. And as a narrative species, we still haven't made that adjustment. Right. So we keep saying, well, what is the market pricing in? The market's pricing nothing in. It has no
Right.
idea what you're talking about. There's nobody at Vanguard paying attention to the Apple earnings call. There's nobody, doing any of this stuff anymore. And candidly, the rest of us have become increasingly nihilistic and throwing up our hands. We're like, none of it makes any sense. Well, that's because we're thinking about it as lagging as compared to an increasingly mechanical tool that reflects the flows that are occurring tied to lagging indicators as compared to leading indicators.
Yep.
So
Okay,
it's
Tracy.
this is a super challenging and interesting time period, particularly in developed markets. We're used to thinking about China data as being garbage, but it's unusual to think about US data as being garbage. And when it comes out, and this is the last thing I would just say on this, Tony, is your suspicion of the BLS, like it's an unintended consequence of over-indexing on the models,
Yeah.
right?
Okay,
They're just
so
wrong.
I want to go into that for a little bit, and I wasn't planning on talking about this, but like when I was working in China, I was talking to one of the data scientists from Baidu, And he told me that they have a better idea of daily GDP readings than the Chinese government does, than the BLS does. And they were considering developing something around like a daily economic activity reading. So I just don't understand, where we have, say, I mean, I hate to do this, but Google or, all the people who have all of this data, we could actually have a compilation of daily activity that doesn't take a bunch of government statisticians. This just comes up kind of automatically segmented. Albert, you're saying no.
No, you can do it, but they don't want it.
No, they
You
don't.
know,
Yeah, that's
no,
the
that's
good thing.
why would they want sort of transparency like that when they can use the BLS and COLA adjustments and anything else to, rally the markets or make growth look like it's supposed, it's positive. I mean, I think Steiner from Hedgeye went through how the federal and state government single-handedly turbocharged the economy in Q1 last year through COLA adjustments and other nonsense like the BLS, like Mike was talking about.
Right.
Accounted for 80% of the growth with Yellen and the Treasury being 40% of it, and the reality that growth has been negative 20 last year.
Right.
And we can go through all these government statistics like Mike was talking about and start shredding them apart, but the reality is perception is reality with the markets, and these
It's PR.
algos and these algos and traders are just gonna take whatever face value number is thrown at them and they're gonna trade it. That's just the reality of it. No one cares about revisions. Nobody.
Right. And this is the thing that I'll just kind of, as a side note, say all the stuff that you're hearing about company implementation generally of things like AI and machine learning is just reactive to some of these headline numbers. And a lot of what you're hearing about, say, enterprises deploying AI, as Mike said with the BLS, they're ARIMA algorithms, which is just simply a moving average. So very few of these companies you hear about kind of deploying AI are actually deploying real machine learning algorithms. They're deploying things like ARIMA to decide what their business is going to do. And with you can do that in Excel, right? So now, before we get off of this really bad data topic, Tracy, I want to, you are notorious for talking about API data. So can you talk to us a little bit about, because, when we talk about, say, market data, that's market clearing data, right? When we talk about government data, that's statistically driven fiction. But when we talk about things like API data, that's supposed to be kind of supply and utilization data. So how is that kind of stuff developed?
Well, I think, well, API, first of all, if you look at API versus EIA, which is, the American Petroleum Institute, which is a private entity compared to EIA, which is obviously government. If you look at the API data, the thing with that data that why it's kind of hit or miss is because it's not mandatory. So it's just voluntary reporting to a trade union. That's it. And so, if you don't have time to report that week, you don't have time to report that week.
Okay.
So that's where you kind of sometimes get hit or miss. I mean, most people do report to it, but again, it's not mandatory. That said, it is mandatory to report to EIA, but I've been talking about this since about 20, well, since 2020, we've seen a huge deterioration in the data because of some of the metrics that they have changed, right? They had this adjustment and they kept kind of, which is literally a fudge factor. Like, it's pretty much like this is how much we plus or minus think we're off this week because of the increasing amount of NGLs that these wells are producing. And so that number has, and then that number's been wild because they really can't keep track of it. So that fluctuation week to week really is too much of a fudge. Like it shouldn't be, 10, 15 million barrels
Sure.
a week. And then they just changed the definition again. They've, fudged it a little bit again in September. And then we've seen their demand data has been off, by the time they get to their monthly reports. So guys, I would tell you, it's 2 months lagging, but the 9/14 monthly reports are much better as far as data is concerned.
Okay, so a lot of this has to do with whether it's the establishment data on labor or whether it's EIA or whatever. It has to do with response rates, right? So we're using, say, survey-based methodologies that haven't changed in, say, 20, 30 years, and expecting that to reflect the market today. So again, as people who watch this use government data, use industry association data, other things that are not market clearing, they have to be aware that there are huge flaws in those data sets and in those responses. Now, Tracy, when you said that EIA changed their methodology, do they then do retroactive changes on the previous data sets?
No.
Of course not. Okay. That makes, I mean, on some level, that makes sense. So, Mike, you were about to add something?
No, I guess I would just say a couple of things, right? When we say that the data is fiction or flawed, like it's a best attempt, but we tend to forget, you know, we look at things like, you know, averages. You mentioned a moving average, et cetera, and we don't adjust those for the standard deviations around that, right? So one of the things that you're seeing all over the place is discussions of the presidential cycle and all these components. Like the reality is that the variance or the variability of outcomes dwarfs the averages, right? I can say, yes, in Democrat, you know, third year or fourth year election years, there's been outperformance over, you know, prior years in terms of the history. But remember, you've only got a few of those observations over any meaningful period. When people start saying things like, you know, in the data set since 1950,
Right.
well, there's just not that many election years
Right.
where Democrats were in charge. Like you just get this incredibly small N, right? Which is the, you know, number of observations, which tells you that the data sets are basically just designed. Like what people are trying to do is grab your attention with, you know, interesting factoids that have no
Yep.
statistical relevance whatsoever,
Yep.
right? And then we get upset when the data reverses. I'm like, oh, it was manipulated, or it was, you know, blah, 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 right? Like it's
Yeah.
just, I'm sorry, that just doesn't actually mean anything. It,
Right.
we're over-indexing on stuff that has no statistical validity.
Exactly. Okay, let's move on to looking at some industrial metals. Tracy, I want to talk to a little bit about industrial metals and what's happening. But first, I want to have a very quick conversation about what's happening in Yemen right now. What's happening in terms of impact on crude price and impact on shipping. So can we cover that real quick? We saw crude prices spike overnight. What do you expect to happen in the short term with crude prices?
I think that this has definitely put a near-term floor under it, but we have to see how the next days and weeks sort of play themselves out. But for now, it's put a floor underneath it. I mean, we haven't certainly didn't see oil prices spike as much as they did, say, when Russia invaded Ukraine. I think we were up like $7 on the day. I mean, we were up $3 earlier. We've come back down a little bit. So certainly we're not getting that kind of a reaction, but I think that this is going to keep at least oil prices elevated. Now, the news that did come out this morning, I think that is more interesting, is that by and large, mostly tankers have been transiting the Suez and the Red Sea. And it's mostly been the container shipping market that has been avoiding it, big Maersk and all the
Yeah.
big players as far as that's concerned. But we had Intertanko, which represents 70% of the world's oil and gas tankers, has told its members to, for the first time, warned, its members that they should, stay out of the Red Sea. Now, of course, it's just a warning right now. It's not, this is what you must do. But if we, it certainly would make a difference if we started seeing these tankers, by and large, in the amounts that we're seeing these container ships start rerouting. That will add a whole new dynamic, as in, extra fuel consumption, things of that nature that might spook the markets a little bit. And I think that's part of, the reason we're seeing elevated prices today, not only because of the attack, but because now tankers are being told, we don't really think you should transit this area. And
Right.
so I think that's, I think that's probably the bigger news. And again, we're going to have to see how this all plays out. But, keep your eye on the tanker market. Certainly, even more ships having to go around the Cape, adding, 10 to 30 days, depending on your export hub origination. is going to matter as far as extra fuel consumption.
Interesting.
Yeah, but the extra fuel consumption is actually equal to the Suez Canal toll. So there's not really a cost difference. It's just a timing difference, right? And so that's what I'd have to add to that.
And so that's mostly fuel for Europe, right? So could we see a midwinter spike in energy prices in Europe?
Well, I think the seasonality really starts about mid-February anyway. It's maintenance season. As maintenance season starts, and that's generally just this seasonal kind of trend in oil. You know, I wouldn't count on it since 2020 and oil prices went negative, and with COVID and, you know, the world economy shut down. So seasonality hasn't been as regular as it has been in the past, but that is kind of when seasonality does start.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, there's also, Tony, there's plenty of Russian oil floating around Turkey.
Yeah, there is.
The Dutch can buy as much as they want.
Good. That's good to know. Okay. Let's move on to industrial metals, Tracy. You know, with rate expectations of the U.S. moderating, we saw industrial metal prices and junior miner valuations begin to rally. I've got a chart of copper futures and the Sprott Junior Copper Miners ETF on screen. But we've really seen them start to fall off coming into January. Now, of course, today they're up a little bit, but not as much as, say, crude. When you look at things like industrial metals, what are you looking at right now? And how do you look at the, say, the junior miners differently than you look at the raw metals prices themselves?
Well, I think really when we're talking about industrial metals, to me, it's really an H2 story of this year rather than H1. I think it's going to be a little touch and go here because I personally don't think that they are going to cut rates in March. Right. And I think that would be probably second half of the year. I could totally be wrong on that, but I just don't really see that happening. I think the market's getting too ahead of themselves. But, you know, generally, when you see rate cuts, that's generally better for metals and for metal miners because their projects become a little bit more affordable. You have to understand these miners borrow a lot of money to get these projects off the ground. There's a lot of financing. There's also, you know, cost of carry, storage, things of that nature for the middleman when you're talking commodity market. So that's a very rate sensitive environment when you're looking at borrowing costs that are so large. And so when you start cutting rates, I think that's going to ease a little bit of that burden and of their bottom line. Also, we likely see, you know, USD to come off a little bit. That's always supportive of, or tends to be supportive of metals. And so, you know, I think that's more of an H2 story. That said, if we look at something like copper, I'm very bullish on copper. I think that, you know, because of the renewable energy push, because of the mining supply disruptions that are going on right now and not coming back, and because of the deficits in the market, supply demand deficits, you know, I think as soon as we see rates come down and the dollar back off a little bit, I think that will be very supportive.
Okay. Now, how much of your bullish, say, copper story is dependent on demand in 24? Because if we look at Mike's jobs chart and the indication that, you know, a recession is on the way, how much of that is dependent on that innate demand factor versus, say, the EV growth factor and other things?
Well, I think obviously that would weigh heavily across markets. But, you know, when we look at commodities, generally, you know, even when we've had a recession, let's take 2008 over to 2020, because that was a totally different kind of environment. But if you look at 2008 and you look at the commodity sector in particular, metals and energy bounced back faster than anything else in the market. Right? Because it's still relatively inelastic. You know, if you look at the energy sector, people still have to go to work. People still have to take their kids to school or, you know, get the bus or, you know, the nation still has to run, even if you're So we definitely see those demand numbers bounce back faster than anything else. And the same with industrial metals, because manufacturing still happens, and the economy still has to run.
Okay, good. So there's a baseline there. Okay, and we also saw China PPI numbers way down last night too, or this morning. So as we see those factory gate prices, that probably put some downward pressure on industrial metals as well. I would think at least in the short term. No, is that a factor?
Absolutely. Everybody looks at China when you're talking about industrial metals just because of the giant manufacturing hub that they are, right? And so everybody looks at iron ore, everybody looks at copper, everybody looks at, all the basic industrial metals that you need for manufacturing steel, for construction and things of that nature. And so, I feel like everybody counts on China to sort of save the whole complex. But we are seeing demand in other places springing up in, other Asian nations, for example, and in Africa, they're coming up, and in India, they're coming up. So though we're seeing losses out of China, we are seeing gains in demand in other countries.
Okay, that's good to know. Okay, thanks for that. So speaking of potential rate rise in March, Albert, let's talk a little bit about a very interesting topic around central banks. Let's talk about the Yellen factor. Okay, so just to cover a couple of central banks first, and then we'll come back to Yellen. We saw earlier this week some test balloons coming out of the Bank of Japan saying they're going to end negative rates in Q2. The former policy director said they're completely ready to end negative rates. So that would, one would assume strengthen JPY, which would be, I guess, interesting. And then at the same time, we had kind of who I think is among the world's worst central bankers, Lagarde, saying that Europe is not in a serious recession, which isn't really all that comforting since she said serious. So it's kind of a very nothing to see here moment. And she, of course, said the ECB won't cut rates until, they're sure that inflation is conquered and all this other stuff. And so I think there's this assumption that the Fed is really in charge of a lot, not just in the US, but globally. And a lot of these other central banks are dependent on the Fed. But we do have a person in the background who seems quite powerful, who knows both the Fed landscape and the US Treasury landscape, in Janet Yellen. So can you talk us through Yellen's role, what she's doing, and kind of the power she has, not just over the Fed, but over some of these other central banks?
Well, I mean, I like to limit the central banks to the US and Anglosphere plus Japan, because those are the only really important ones. Now, the ECB, yeah, sure. But right now they're in a zombie status for their economy. I mean, Lagarde talks about, a serious recession. They're in a depression right now in Europe. But aside from that, Janet Yellen has dialogue with all these central banks. So does Powell. Right, they sit there and they discuss what policy actions they're gonna throw out there. They don't surprise one another. Nobody does that, especially in today's interconnected markets. It's just simply you can't think that they act independently anymore. Sure, something could happen overnight and they have to act, react, so on and so forth. But when you talk about long-term policy goals, the Fed and Yellen will sit there and pick up the phone and talk. I know for a fact they do. All right. I know for a fact that they get information and they prompt the Australian Central Bank to do so on and so forth with their currency, whether they devalue it or raise rates or so on and so forth. Right. So, I mean, Yellen, her desire is to keep the US markets elevated. And it's right now it's a purely a political thing. And I know Mike's going to chime in here a little bit later, but from what I know, and plenty of people I talk to, it is purely politics in her eyes, right? So she's looking right now to use all of the remaining reverse repo for the election, simply for the election going into Q3. Right now, she's looking to probably do about $1.2 trillion in bills by Q3, which is absolutely massive. And the fact that you said that she knows how things work in the Fed and how things work in the Treasury, well, she wants to neuter Powell and the Fed and being able to, like, you know, raise rates and offset any kind of, like, you know, market pumps that she has planned right now. So, I mean, 1.2 trillion is at least $200 billion more than even the highest estimates that I've seen of anybody else. Right. Because, you know, and the way I understand it works that, like, she gets her bills bonanza and QT is killed because that QT is going to end this year. Right. Now, I like we can talk about and how what that happens to inflation for 2024. But, I, you know, Mike is right about 2025 and going onwards that, you know, inflation is probably going to taper off in those years. But for the election, I absolutely think that Yellen, you know, double pumps this market and, you know, gets the narrative that the economy is good, you know, simply by using our reverse repo and all these other narratives that she builds through the other central banks globally.
Okay, so what is she spending that $1.2 trillion on?
Honestly, that's above my pay grade, right? that really is. I mean, I can tell you what they're doing. I, you know, when you talk about the plumbing and the mechanics, you know, Mike probably knows way better than I. I know that she uses investors in the reverse repo as a prime source of liquidity, right? Not all of it, but a significant, right? That's as much as I know about that.
Yeah, so I mean, just to offer a couple of observations. I mean, one, when we talk about it being all political, it's always all political, right? Let's just be really clear. The Treasury does not have a policy statement that mandates their behavior. And so when the Treasury is pursuing something, it is explicitly pursuing something in the interests of the administration.
Right? That's like, exactly right.
You know, it's actually really important for people to understand there's nothing nefarious about that. It's actually very different if the Fed gets involved and begins pumping a political agenda. That may or may not happen, and I'm certain that it happens to a greater degree than we'd like to acknowledge. But the simple reality is she is a member of Biden's cabinet. Her objective is to push Biden's agenda. That includes getting Biden reelected in part because the Biden administration sees the election of Trump as one of the most concerning possible outcomes for the U.S. over and above a traditional election type dynamic. Whether that's correct or not, that is actually above my pay grade, right? Because that requires looking in the future and something that we can't just see. The second component is when you talk about like what she's going to spend it on, I actually think we largely know what they are going to spend it on, right? They've already told us the inflation, you know, the inappropriately named Inflation Reduction Act is going to continue to push domestication of supply chains, the investment in critical supply chains component. And that's been one of the key drivers of the better than expected GDP is that the U.S. trade deficit has deteriorated or has improved dramatically over the past year or so. Right. So it's actually like I do think those things are important for people to understand relative to GDP. We've seen an improvement. We're seeing, you know, largely tied to the dramatic increase in oil production in the United States. We're seeing the U.S., you know, the U.S. is now the world's largest oil producer, bar none. And that's happening under a Democratic administration. Right. The whole drill, baby, drill type framework actually occurred under a Democrat. And, you know, so I think it's important to kind of identify that. The last point that I think you guys are emphasizing, which is the use of the RRP or the incentive to not fully fund, effectively drawing down non-bank deposit reserves in order to fund the payments that go out from the U.S. government, that is a liquidity pump, right? And from that standpoint, I think it's important for people to understand that when you use bills or you use RRP, is your source of financing, you're using an asset that carries effectively zero volatility weight, right? So if I use 30-year bonds and somebody goes out and buys a 30-year bond to provide financing for the U.S. government, they have to be very cognizant that the value of that bond can vacillate fairly significantly. That creates uncertainties in terms of asset values that reduces my incentive to go out and spend those proceeds or to continue to spend, because I'm now like, well, I'm not entirely sure what my asset value is, right? When you use bills, there's none of that uncertainty. It actually goes even slightly worse. You don't even need to put out, because bills are discounted mechanisms, just to make life simple. If I buy a one-year bond yielding 5%, or one-year bill yielding 5%, I'm paying 95 cents and I'm getting a dollar back in the future. That is absolutely cash that is being returned into the system at a lower cost to the system than if I had to fully fund a dollar purchase of a 5% bond, for example, right? So all of these things matter. I just think we got to be a little bit careful in like, you know, this is uniquely Yellen or this is uniquely, Mnuchin or, you know, somebody else, right? That's always the objective of the Treasury. They
Yeah.
serve at the pleasure of the president.
Yeah, their liquidity analysis is dubious at best, but the US bubble sucks in so much capital at this point that they may be running out of sources. I don't know. I mean, $400 trillion is a lot. It's a lot of money, a lot of money to jack. Nobody can do a
400
liquidity
billion, just to be
analysis.
clear, but 400 billion, not 400 trillion.
Oh yeah,
But
sorry,
yes,
400
it's,
billion. Yeah, but I mean, do a
we'll get there
liquidity
eventually. Don't worry. The Bitcoiners are telling us that.
doing liquidity analysis on 430 billion is not easy,
Right.
as
I agree with that. And I also think the other component is remember that a lot, this goes back to the narrative type dynamic, right? When the stock market goes up, we want to explain why. Right. And so, like, all sorts of, liquidity, blah, blah, blah. Well, liquidity can be used to fund lots of things, including money under the mattress, right? So, you like just be aware that it doesn't always mean exactly what people think it means.
So I want to go back to one thing you mentioned, Albert. You said QT is definitely ending this year. So
Oh, yeah.
we're at about, what, $8 trillion on the Fed balance sheet, something like that?
The Fed
Is
balance
that
sheet is
right?
more like 12 trillion when you take in all the, the swaps that they got with other banks and whatnot. But
Oh, that's
on
good to know.
paper, yeah, it's 8 trillion. Yeah. And when you want to use the paper number, yeah, it's 8 trillion.
Sure. Okay. So, and it's, I guess, normally around 2 trillion, something like that, or at least has been for the past 5, 6, 7 years, something like that. So 8 trillion is the new norm. Is that what you're saying on the Fed balance sheet?
Yeah, I mean it's been elevated, been going up every year. I mean we use excuses now, like COVID and Europe in 2012 and so on and so forth. I mean, they'll find excuses to keep the balance sheet up. It's I don't even take that even seriously anymore.
Okay, Mike, what's your thought on that?
I'm hopeful that Albert is wrong, but I'm really
Me too. Me
in
too.
favor.
I'm on your side. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why they couldn't continue to siphon it off
You know why?
incrementally.
You know why? Because this is a purely political nonsense. This is the reason why inflation stays elevated and high, is because the political policies get in the way of economics and common sense. That's why. Right? There is nothing that the Biden administration has ever shown me that they are willing to do something economically logical. That's why, right? That's purely my baseline of reasoning behind all
I
this.
mean, in fairness, we could say the same thing about the last 2 years of the Trump
Yeah,
administration.
I was going to say, like, again, it's no, to me, you don't need to assign one party versus another, right? They both have behaved in economically irrational manners to prosecute their objectives. Part of it is it's just that we don't have a good model that actually explains this stuff, right? I mean, deficits don't matter. That comes, from the Reagan and Bush administrations, right? When I come back, I want to be the bond market, right? James Carville with the Clinton administration, right? There is no political allegiance to any of this stuff. Simple reality is that sometimes it matters and sometimes it doesn't, right? And it all depends on where you are in a business cycle and where you are in a capacity utilization cycle, et cetera. And that's very frustrating for people who always want to hear that 2 + 2 = 4, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't.
Mike, I had a question for you. Like, one of the main theses I had is like, it doesn't matter because Asia and Europe are just non-existent at the moment, right? If we had some kind of counterbalance, yeah, then the United States would have some problems, right?
I totally
But
agree.
yeah, because they're dead. Asia's dead right now, right? And Europe is, I don't even know what Europe is. It's just a vacation, Club Med, a big
Nikkei's
club.
rallying.
Yeah, okay, sure. Yeah, well, I mean, Japan's different though. Japan's a little bit different, but I'm saying China itself, China and Europe are completely dead. For that reason, we have no accountability, right? We can do whatever we want. I'm not saying it's good, but in the short term, we can do whatever we want. It's probably going to bite us in the ass 10 years down the line, but for today, who's going to hold us accountable?
I think in general, I mean, again, like I think that there's parts of what Albert's saying that I absolutely agree with, right? We all know the including myself, the overweight individual who knows that there's consequences associated with being overweight but doesn't want to change their behaviors, right? You can tell them that on Tuesday, you can tell them that on Wednesday, you can tell them that on Thursday, and it's not going to change their behavior. And for that matter, they're going to sit there and increasingly be like, "Stop nagging me." Right. It's only once they have the catastrophic heart attack and they recognize that there are actually distinct consequences But at that point, their future as an athlete is finished, right? There is like no real opportunity there. So there will be eventually a heart attack that hits for exactly the reasons that Albert's saying, if we continue to make bad policy and basically consume Twinkies for breakfast. But in the meantime, man, Twinkies are tasty.
Yeah, they are.
They're deep fried Twinkies too, on top of that.
Particularly if you deep fry them, right? Exactly, right?
Then cover them in chocolate.
Yeah,
Exactly, right.
yeah,
because we got to
And at every
assemble
stage
later.
in that process, somebody's saying, you know, oh, that doctor doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. I'm totally fine, right?
Yeah, that's a
So
perfect
it's
analogy.
no
That's a
different with
perfect.
political administrations. What's
Yeah, it's a
up?
perfect analogy. Is like the Twinkie, deep fried chocolate covered Twinkie, because we have Ozempic. Yeah, that's not going to stop the heart disease, right?
Right.
It's going to make it look good.
Well, the irony is that if you combine Ozempic and the Twinkie, right, you now have increased consumption and you've introduced innovative new technologies that you can value richly. And if they're paid for with government deficits, that shows up as phenomenal to GDP growth, right?
But let me
Yeah,
add
that's
your
exactly right.
analogy. Twinkie, Ozempic, and testosterone shots, since we're goosing the defense budget. So,
Right,
I mean,
my
those
gut
three
doesn't look
things.
my gut doesn't look nearly as bad because I've pumped up my upper body, right? It's you know,
Perfect.
congratulations.
So, on that Twinkie note, let's just end it on a happy Twinkie note, okay?
There we go.
So this is great, guys. We could go on for hours. Thank you so much for this. I really appreciate your time, all the thoughts you put into this. Have a great weekend. Have a great week ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care.